Just want to let you lot know that if you're watching this clip on the Fozcast YouTube channel, the full episode is now available to watch exclusively on Spotify. And it's free. Come on.
When I won the World Championship 1 year, they gave me a Ferrari.
No, they did
yeah,
not.
And another time, they gave me a Bentley. Sometimes we'd fall out over it. I mean, it would know the shit out of me because he couldn't put two balls in a row. Steve Davis had six.
Yeah.
And it was like when I got to seven, I couldn't register right what now. He had to start drinking, I think, about 3 or 4 hours before every match. He had a condition that he had the shakes. He tried to claim VAT or tax back on them.
On the beers?
On the beers.
That's a work expense, all right.
I was absolutely smashed. And then the next day I had to do an appearance at a sweater shop. Stopped three times to go and be ill in the toilets. I told my ex-wife that before going down to the start of the tournament to bring a certain jacket I want to wear after the final.
Oh, I love that. So,
and that was before the tournament started.
I would say it's the most perfect thing you can do in sport. Welcome to the Fozcast, everybody. We are on the road again today. We're in sunny Reading. It's not sunny Reading. It's horrible outside. It's freezing cold. However, we're in the lovely warm next to a beautiful heated snooker table. And that is because today's guest is a bit of a legend, I won't lie to you. At the tender age of 21, became the youngest ever snooker world champion. A record he still holds to this very day. He's won everything there is to win in the game. One of the best players to have ever graced this. What's it called? What's the green stuff
felt
called? Felt
Baize.
One of the best players who have ever graced this beautiful green Baize. It's Stephen Hendry. Before we start talking about your career, because mm-hmm. there's so much to talk about, I've got loads of questions, loads of bits of bobs I want to know. You're now a YouTuber.
Yes.
Talk to me about this new murky world of YouTube that you've just entered.
Well, we did Q-tips on Instagram, where we would do a season of shots where we'd ask people to write in shots they're having problems with. So you'd have a season of sort of 20 or 30 shots. And obviously the next progression after that was, because obviously that's done on a phone, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's like short form, it's short clips and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, 59 seconds maximum. So the next step was obviously YouTube. And it's something that's never been done before where a top player has presented a show where he's just having a couple of frames with other top players and people like yourself, obviously, that love snooker. It's going really well. It's really exciting. I'm enjoying doing it. I think the players are enjoying it because in sport, when you get asked, you do press stuff or TV, you're very much like, you
guided.
Know, you go through the motions kind of thing. So it's cool just have the players chilling out and just we're having a laugh as well.
It can be a bit stuffy as well, can't it? But like we were saying earlier on, like, actually, with snooker players, you'll have your waistcoat on. It's very serious. You're very focused. To actually bring it like snooker back to what it is,
down
the club,
a t-shirt
with your mates.
Yeah,
that's what it is, right?
I think the good thing about it as well, when we're doing the Q&As with Q is spelled CUE, by the way.
Yeah,
do you get it
like that.
as we're going to the players where they practice. So the people that are watching it are getting to see where the clubs where they practice, or with Judd Trump, it was just in an office block where he's put two tables.
Wow, and that's where he practices.
That's where he practices. Neil Robertson went to a club in Cambridge, Mark Worm's club in the Valleys in Wales. So you're getting to see where these players do their work day in, day out as well, which is cool.
I've got to say, you are an absolute natural, mate. Seriously.
Snooker,
yeah. So we've just filmed, a video, haven't we, for Steve. By the way, the YouTube channel, Stephen Hendry's Q-Tips. If you have not subscribed to it yet, get yourself over there. It is incredible. You're nearly on 100,000 already, by the way. You've only been going like 2 months.
Have you seen the nice little plaque you'll get soon?
Oh, really? No, yeah, we're delighted with how it's going. I mean, credit, obviously, to all the guys that are producing and stuff, because they're doing wonders. I'm just basically standing around a table chatting to other snooker players. But it's going fantastically well, and it's hard work. More for the guys. They have to edit, do all this stuff in the background. But I'm enjoying it. It's a new challenge.
Is that the bit for you that I think might have opened your eyes a little bit? Is I think a lot of people, the perception of YouTube is you kind of just pull your phone out or whatever it is, a GoPro, and it's just as simple as click record and then just upload it, and simple as that. It's nowhere near that, is it? It's so much more, isn't it?
Well, if we want the channel to sort of keep moving growing, on and improving and growing. We've got to keep at it. Yeah. You've got to keep doing it. I mean, we might run out of snooker players at some point to
footballers, mate. Start getting footballers. Yeah. A lot of footballers play snooker. I know for a fact a lot of footballers play snooker.
A lot of players have tables in the houses, don't they?
Yeah. I used to have a snooker table in my house. So snooker in the Foster household, right? It was a big deal as a kid. Honestly, it was a big deal. My dad's here today, and my dad's never come to a podcast before. Honestly, my dad has never come to a podcast, right? And this one, when I told him we were going to be doing one with you, oh my gosh, Ben, I'm coming. So he's watched the video that we've made today. He's absolutely buzzing. He's all over it. But yeah, when we were kids, it was always on the telly. Like snooker was a proper big deal back in the day, wasn't it? We were even joking about some like the TV shows. Remember like Pot Black and Big Break. Like Jim Davidson, John Virgo, Big Break, all that kind of, that was prime time TV, wasn't it?
Snooker was huge. I think pre-Sky, it was on BBC, ITV. It was one of the top sports actually on TV at those times. And obviously Sky came, which sort of elevated football to a whole new level. And there was so much choice thereafter to watch in terms of sport, like golf and all sorts. So snooker went down a wee bit. But then in the 80s and 90s, I mean, it was massive. I mean, we were like proper stars, which is weird. We were me in the beginning, young to get recognised everywhere. But the likes of, because people still say to me now, there's not the characters in snooker anymore, because they still remember the likes of Bill Werbenuk and Kirk Stevens.
Is he the chap that had like 9-15 pints?
Yeah. He had to start drinking I think about 3 or 4 hours before every match. He had a condition that he had the shakes. So it was either drinking beer or taking a drug. It was banned.
Yeah.
So beta blockers, I think it was. So yeah, he had to go the other way of having a few beers.
Wow!
And I think it was public knowledge that he tried to claim VAT or tax back on them
on the beers
on the beers he drinks.
This sounds like you.
I like his thinking here. Mate. That's a work expense, all right. He has to have that kind of stuff.
He did have to go to the toilet every frame though, which was a.
Oh, yeah, that's a long session, that is, if he's doing that all the time. I mentioned my dad a minute ago, right? So, like I say, my dad is, he's run the local snooker team, our Lillington C team. Like I say, we're avid, we're amateur, and we're very average, honestly. We're very, very average. But you were 21 years old, you're a young Stephen Hendry, right? You're playing in the tournaments, you're winning everything, and then you're doing also, like, you do the rounds, you do the clubs and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you came to our area, you came to a club near to us called the Cubbington Club, okay?
Right.
And my dad was, like, as everybody was, just buzzing to come and get a glimpse of a young Stephen Hendry. And anyway, he entered the raffle. The raffle prize was a signed Stephen Hendry snooker case with a cue inside it, absolutely buzzing. And my dad went and won the raffle, right? So I've got a picture here now. I'm going to show it. If you're watching this on Spotify, by the way, everybody, just give your phone. If you're watching on your phone, just give your phone a little turn to the side, right? And you'll see the video. This is a picture of my dad getting the cue off of you. 31 years ago, Dad?
So this could be the mullet years. I want to guess it's the mullet years.
This is 100%. No, this is not the mullet years.
It's not the mullet. Is it the bleach blonde years?
I think it might be. Yeah, wavy. You're handsome as you like, by the way, back in the day. Dad, you're looking a million and all. Honestly. You two could have had a night out and just nicked all sorts here, by the way. Just have a little look at this. We'll put them on screen so you can have a good look at them. Have a look at that little bad boy.
Wow.
How cool is that?
The sweater shop. That was my sponsor, the sweater shop.
Was it really?
Yeah, yeah. They were great. So they were the ones, when I won the World Championship 1 year, they gave me a Ferrari.
No, they did not.
And another time they gave me a Bentley Continental GT or something.
What, was like a bonus?
Yeah, it's a bonus for winning the World Championship.
Just a well done. Here
and,
you
and,
go.
And I knew this before, because one time I was clearing up against Jimmy, I think it was when I beat him 18-17, and I'm clearing the colours. And I shouldn't have been thinking about it, but I'm thinking I'm going to get a Bentley. I should have been thinking this is for the world title, but I couldn't help it. It was just coming in when I was like clearing the colours. It's like, wow. But yeah, they were amazing sponsors. Yeah,
are they still in business?
No, they sold up. They made fortunes. They sold
up. Wow,
but wow, what a picture.
Oh, it's belting, isn't it?
I look like someone from a boy band.
You look a million, honestly. I'm absolutely buzzing with this picture. I remember seeing this picture. Like I say, I remember my dad coming home.
He tucks their sweaters into their jeans.
I know. That was the look, though, wasn't it? It was what it was. My dad's massive glasses on him. Actually, you've still got massive glasses now, Dad. But yeah, I remember my dad coming home that night. He's just won this snooker cue. He's buzzing. I think it's a Riley snooker cue. Anyway, he was buzzing so much of it. Later that week, he sold it to somebody at the club for 60 quid.
No.
He did. He sold it for 60 quid. good.
Fantastic.
It's class, though. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Right, where are we going then? So, young Stephen Henry, like you said there, sort of like you say, back in the day, when you're a youngster, you're winning tournaments right, left and centre. Just how famous are you at this moment in time? Are you able to just go and do any normal stuff whatsoever?
I think the fact that I lived in Scotland helped a bit. I think if I'd moved down south, it might have been more of a problem. I did get recognised everywhere, but it was... In Scotland, football was everything in the papers. I mean, it was all the sort of tabloids. You six pages of Rangers and Celtic, maybe a page of the other teams, and then snooker would still
a little bit of liberty back.
So it was football dominated. But it was strange. Learning to be, well known and people know who you are because I was just kind of grew up normal family and nothing out of the ordinary. So for this to happen was, it's pretty random.
Did it take much to adapt to? Because obviously back then it would have been maybe someone asking for an autograph.
Yeah.
So obviously if you were a 21-year-old Stephen Hendry right now with a world of camera phones, it's a very different
social
level.
Social media, all that kind of stuff.
You could still be conspicuous to a point, couldn't you?
I think it's important, and I was very lucky. I had good background from my parents, and my manager was very good at keeping me. I didn't do any sort of interviews, front of papers.
Kept you away from all that. Yeah,
kept me away. The odd one I did, we sort of found out straight away that they were looking for an angle, and then we just sort of kept away from it. You do realise that you're even then you're everything you do in your life becomes public. Property,
it's going to get out there eventually.
Or knowledge, so that's sometimes is difficult to get used to. But I mean, I just love what I did. It was great for me. I was the best snooker player in the world. So it was just anything that was slightly negative, I didn't even think about.
Joe, one thing I found interesting. So like I say, we've already filmed a video for the YouTube channel earlier, and you were asking me about Sir Alex Ferguson and the hairdryer treatment, that kind of stuff. And you said your manager used to do exactly the same thing to you, and I said, hold on, your manager. So you're the guy out there in front of the cameras, performing, producing the goods kind of thing. And yet still you would get back into the changing room. Your manager would be on you.
I mean, sometimes would fall out over it. I mean, he'd know the shit out of me because he couldn't put two balls in a row. And he would criticize my shot choice and things like that. You shouldn't have gone for that. And I was like, look, you can but it used to work. It used to really get me going and go out and I'd like, it didn't work every time. But a lot of times it got me real my back up and I'd go out and play really well. But he kind of took me over my career when I was 16, when I turned pro, because my dad used to take me everywhere. But obviously he couldn't afford to travel as a professional is a lot more expensive than just going to amateur tournaments.
Yeah.
So the booking hotels, because one thing my manager did was said, if you're going to be a professional, you're going to stay in the same hotel as Steve Davis. You're not going to, because if you stay in a little bed and breakfast and he's in the hotel, you're going to feel inferior.
Yeah.
So I think that was quite an important thing. So it obviously cost money. And he sort of brought this sort of work ethic into me as well, because I wasn't practicing really. I was mucking around my mates. He instilled, he says, if I'm going to financially back you, look after everything, you're going to work your bollocks off, basically, his words. So I was in the club 6 hours a day, 7 days a week, on my own plate, and I hated it at the beginning. It was like, oh my God, this was a hobby. This was something I enjoyed.
Yeah.
And now this is like a job. But after about a month or two, I could feel my game was just changing and getting better with this practice, and I could see results.
How did you practice? Like, I know that might seem like a strange question, but did you just play snooker more? Or did you have drills to do, or position the balls a certain way, or just play like a frame?
No, I would do things like the lineup where you just set the reds up the middle of the table and just try and clear the table, red color. And I'd try and do it 10 in a row. And even if I got to 7 or 8, I would go back to 1 if I'm missing 7 or 8. And that was that, partly because I thought this is the best way of getting the time going quicker, because if you're doing this,
you've got to
take
to
longer.
Yeah.
6 hours. It was like, how can I make the time go faster? How can to occupy the time? Because if I mean, just play frames, 6 hours would seem like 26 hours. So I had something to sort of train myself to do, and that drilling that concentration. That's what made me so good in matches.
To get to your level, like with the football, you'd have Ronaldo and Messi, and it's nature versus nurture. Mm. What was Stephen Hendry? Is it a mixture of both? How do you get to that level?
I got a little table for my Christmas 2 weeks before my 13th birthday.
Like a little six-foot bad boy.
I never played snooker before. My granddad was a very good player. He died before I was born. My dad was rubbish. Yeah. He couldn't put two balls in a row. So it skipped a generation. But within 2 or 3 weeks, I was making 50 breaks.
Wow.
On a small table. So, yeah, I just got better and better very quickly. So you obviously have to be born with a talent. That's the first off.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not born with that...
What is it? Is it a hand-eye thing?
Yeah, it's hard to explain. I just did it. I could just get down on the table and it was natural. You know, you see players who are not natural at snooker and they end up like this with a bridge and like, but I just basically put my hand down, spread it, and it was there. And then I started watching on TV. I just got better very quickly. So the natural talent, born with that talent, was important. Then, you know, becoming a pro and the work ethic. And then you get to a stage where it takes being able to play under pressure, which I was able to do.
When you say about the pressure, so just earlier on, you mentioned that your manager would rare up, have a go at you, and you said he'd get your back up. Mm. First thing that popped in my mind there is, surely you wouldn't want to get the backup of a snooker player, because once you go out there, my perception is you've got to be super calm and super focused. So if you went out like riled up,
angry,
would that not affect your game?
No, it sort of clarified what I was there to do, basically.
Okay.
I'm not saying he did it every single match, but I mean, if he felt I wasn't putting in the effort or concentrating or just not there, he would think that's the way of getting me concentrating, which more often than not it did. So it was just a matter of, if I was like, maybe in the first half of the match, I would be sat in my chair, and when the opponent's at the table, I'm just like this, or you're looking around and not like on it.
What are you thinking of when you're in that moment?
I mean, you said to me in the video, you commentate sort of match kind of thing when you're not active. I would like try and not commentate in a bit, but watch the opponents, what he's doing, try and go through his mind and try and think that, well, where can he mess up? Look at the state of the table and think, well, that's... Yeah. You know, he's got to do that to get into that position.
He's thinking a few shots ahead.
Yeah, he's got to open the reds at some point. Where can it go wrong? And am I ready to sort of step in when it does go wrong? So, yeah, sometimes if you're not on it, focus in, you hear someone in the crowd.
Really, yeah.
And you look up there and then you'll see that. And then all of a sudden you get a chance and your head's nowhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the sort of thing he would pick up on. And times I would see him if he was in the audience watching, I'd catch his eye and he'd be like, I responded to it and I think later on in my career, when you get older, obviously it didn't do it, it's not when you get older, you can't start, but well, I don't know how old the players are when Alex Ferguson, but I mean, you were like 30 year old, you can't have someone coming in. I would rebel against it
because I was
older,
but the younger it's easier to
consequently it's probably one of the reasons why my form dipped after my sort of 30s, is I didn't have that.
Somebody to push you.
I didn't have that check to say, look, you're not concentrating today. I had to rely on myself, so.
I want to talk about the evolution of snooker, basically. I want to a little bit of comparison to what it used to be in the late 80s, 90s, when you were playing to today. Is there any drastic changes? Are people training more? Are they fitter? Is there anything, any kind of nuances in the new game that have made the general play of snooker a bit better?
I think the practice side of it is definitely they're more dedicated now, which it seems to be a trend in a lot of sports. I think you know, going back to people saying there's no characters anymore, I think because sport in general has become so winning, results
clinical,
driven,
isn't it?
Yeah, results driven, that people are putting more effort into that rather than you know, telling joke or having a character. It's just
focus.
Yeah, focus on winning. And that's changed. The amount of practice players do.
It's like the marginal gains, basically. So they must be, so it's like a bit of cycling, you know what I mean? Where they will look at every little facet of either their life, like how they sleep at night, any alcohol they might consume, anything like that, just to get a slight little advantage.
I don't know whether snooker goes into it that deeply. I think there's more, certainly more fitness in terms of, because the players are younger, and there was definitely sort of 70s, 80s, and more of a sort of drinking culture in snooker. You could have drinks by the table, you know, like darts, smoking. I mean, it's incredible to me that I used to play World Championship and Embassy sponsored it, and you're sitting next to someone smoking
away,
You look back and you think, it's
mind-blowing, isn't it?
It's so weird. But yeah, I mean, Ronnie's very fit. Judd's very fit. A lot of the guys do it. I didn't do it 1 minute of fitness.
Really? Yeah.
Not 1 minute. I was naturally fit. I mean, that ship sailed. But I was naturally really thin, so I didn't have to do anything. But I think it's just become more intense.
Yeah.
I think, and you know, the competitive side of it is more intense than it used to be.
I think the reason why I'm saying this is because I remember back in the day, like, say, when I'm watching you play, where if you get a 147 break, it was 147 grand for getting the 147. Do you remember that?
Like, was that every tournament? Or
just a World Championship?
It was a World Championship, yeah. But you think 147 grand, sort of what, 30, 25, 30 years ago, that's about £1 million nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was bonkers, weren't it? But you didn't get that many of them, did you?
No, I think I made either two or three at the World when that was a prize. Because 1 year, I remember, I was getting married in that summer, and the Daily Record, when I did it, put in the front page that I was giving my wife the 147 grand as a wedding present.
Oh,
I mean, where they got that from, I don't even know. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But
I think what they mean is, as soon as you put that ring on her finger, she's entitled to sort of at least that anyway, mate, to be honest with you.
But I mean, it was incredible, and that sort of prize makes you take a risk to go for it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I think the World Championship, it might be 50, I'm not sure. But if it's a tight bit of the match, you won't take a risk.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, not only the 147, you got 20 grand for the highest break as well. So it was 167.
Wow.
So if you did that and won the World Championship, which was 250...
Clean.
Oh, wow,
you know.
Yeah, good week's work.
Yeah, you had a good 2 weeks in Sheffield.
Well, so there's that famous Ronnie O'Sullivan clip, isn't there, where he's on for the 147. He looks to the judge and he's, what is the bonus for getting the 147 this year? And he's like, $5,000?
I know. Like, he didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah, so we went and potted the pink on purpose, right. I know. Sort of like stick two fingers up for him. It's incredible.
I think it's bad. I think there should always be a great prize for a 147.
Yeah, for sure.
If they don't, I mean, one of the arguments is we don't want to give more money. Well, I would give it a car or a beautiful watch
something.
Make
like
a hole in one on the golf holes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the most perfect thing you can do in snooker that doesn't happen that often. It's not like, I mean, 9 darters, I think, are far more common.
I would say it's the most perfect thing you can do in sport. I don't think there's anything else in any sport that would be any more
about
difficult
this
than
day.
Getting a 147.
We were talking about this the other day, weren't we? Do you remember on the golf course? Because we said, right, you play off 7 at golf, I play off 16. We could get a hole in one.
Yeah.
Like, it's one good shot and a bit of luck. 147, you are not doing that unless you are the best of the best.
The argument is always 147, 9-darter, or hole in one. So the 147 is, I think, by far the most difficult.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how the balls are going to be, the position, and it's 36 shots that's going to be perfect. I think next is hole in one. As you say, anyone can make one. There's a bit of luck involved, but it's such a difficult thing to do. The 9-darter, I'm not saying it's not a difficult thing to do, but the dartboard's the same all the time. It doesn't move.
Constant, isn't it?
It doesn't move. You know what numbers you have to go for, and you do it. But anyway, someone will argue with that.
Just talking on 147s then. So there's been a few sort of like cases where players have got to that 140, they're going for the black, and then they've missed it. I've got the three players down here. So obviously the famous Ken Doherty one back in the day. There's John Higgins in 2018,
right,
and then 2015, Unnew.
I was commenting on that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was incredible.
So talk me through that, because you've done it plenty of times yourself, I'm sure. When you're on that, when you know it's on and you're getting to the crunch time, do the nerves start kicking in a bit?
Well, the latest I've missed, I missed a pink at the Benson Hedges Masters. Sorry, I shouldn't be tobacco. But it's automatic. People come up to me and say, when's the Embassy? I mean, it was like, they haven't sponsored it for 20 years.
But that's what it is. That's
like football, isn't it? It's like the Carling Cup. Carling Cup.
So the pink was the latest I got and missed. But I always think that, and it's very rare that a player will miss in the final black, but it's you're almost on autopilot with the concentration.
Yeah,
you're so in the zone because you've done all the hard work, and you're very, if you're going to miss, you miss earlier on. The most misses you'll see in a 147 opportunity will be sort of last red, second last red.
Trying to get them out and stuff, or they might be on the rail or whatever.
But more often, you're so like on it that you don't even... You know what's happening, you're nervous, but the concentration...
Genuinely, you're still just autopilot. Yeah. It doesn't even start to touch the sides or anything. No.
But I mean, it is the biggest buzz you can have. I mean, it's just like, even in practice, it's amazing. Do a 147, it's amazing.
It's like I said to you earlier in our video, in our local snooker league, if we get a 30 break, we get in the paper. We get our name in the paper for like a notable break or something like that. Mm. And I've genuinely had about four or five instances where I've been on a 24, 25 and I'm going for a black and I'm thinking, I'm in the paper here. And then I absolutely bottle it and the hand starts shaking and that's it. It's painful, it is. So fair dues, if you guys can be that laser guided, and it is what it is, and you just pot it.
Did you ever work, obviously with Ronnie, for example? We've had Professor Steve Peters on the podcast.
Right.
Fascinating guy. Like in your heyday of playing, was that ever an option to work with psychologists and that side of the game?
Not obviously in the 90s when it was my dominant period. Obviously I didn't need anyone because I was so dominant. Near the sort of end, I had a coach who went in, not like anywhere near Steve Peters level, but sort of dabbled in that sort of thing. You know, we talked about visualization and meditation and that sort of thing to get you stuff. But I was too far gone to really let it. I think you've got to be
a bit of an old dog, you're almost. Yeah, kind of thing, you know what I mean?
I think you've got to really buy into that for it to work. Yeah. I mean, it was like he said, right, okay. He wanted me to watch old videos of me winning, and I said to him, but yeah, all that says to me is how crap I am now.
Really? Yeah.
I was getting the wrong message from it. He says you should be watching you winning. So when you've got this feeling inside, and when you get to the matches, you'll feel that way. But I said, but all it's reiterating to me is that look how low I've sunk now. I was so good then, and look at me now. That's it kept on.
What is it? Is there any time, like an individual moment, a point in time where you kind of thought about it and thought, I'm not quite what I used to be? Is there any reason why for that would happen as well?
I won my last world title in 99. I said in my press conference, if I don't win another match, I can be happy with my career. So basically, I'm kind of switching off straight away, saying, like, okay, I did win titles after, but not many, no world titles. I don't know whether mentally it was just, I always had that target to get seven. Steve Davis had six.
Yeah.
And it was like when I got to seven, I couldn't register, right, what now?
Yeah.
People say, oh, you go for eight. Yeah, I said, but it was because Steve had six, I had to beat that and had nothing else to
kind of
beat.
So you're competitive then. You must have a real serious competitive nature.
Yeah, so that was always in the distance. And so, I started to develop technical faults. I started to go to two or three different coaches who did different things, which worked for a while and then didn't work. And then you just go down a road of losing, you start losing more than you're winning, and then instead of just going out and winning, you find yourself trying not to lose.
Yeah.
And my game changed. You start being more defensive, and
that's my next question. Is literally that is if you're playing, if you know you're playing the world number one tomorrow, for example, you're playing well, but do you go into that game with a different mindset? Do you think, oh, I need to be a bit more careful, a bit more reserved, not quite go for the pots that I didn't go for yesterday?
I never did when I was dominant, even playing Steve Davis, who used to tie me up in knots at the start with safety. Yeah. I still went for everything.
Really?
And I never ever, when I was in the 90s, never changed my game for anything. If that wasn't going to do the job, I wasn't going to fall back and start playing safe. So, and I developed sort of technical faults in my cue action, as I said, and would then start to avoid certain shots because I knew I didn't feel right in my cue action to pot them. So I did end up playing the wrong way.
It's not your game, is it?
No, and it just snowballed to get worse and worse. And then at the end, when I retired, I thought, look, I'm not enjoying this.
Yeah.
I'm not enjoying losing to people I shouldn't lose to. Steve Davis kept playing. I said to him, what are you doing? You're losing to him. You shouldn't be lacing your shoes. He said, I just treat it as a day out.
Really, yeah. Just enjoys it for what it is.
I can't do that. I said, for me, the winning is the enjoyment.
Yeah, yeah.
That being able to think, or at least knowing you can win if you play well. But I can't deal with that. So maybe I retired too early. I don't know. I could have still got to quarterfinals.
Just work the circuit a bit.
And kept being playing. But anyway, I thought, no, I'm not enjoying this. Get out.
I think that's like the, it's like the, that youth thing, isn't it? The innocence, the beauty, the sort of obliviousness of when you're a youngster. You just don't care. You don't think about like what might happen.
No,
you just,
not at all.
Ah, sod it. I'm just going to pot it and that's all it is.
Exactly. I mean, and that was what Judd Trump, when he came on the scene, he plays a very similar game to what I did. Yeah. Just going for everything and not even thinking about what would happen if you miss.
Yeah.
But the minute you down your career, you start to get sort of scars that, oh, I went for that last time, missed it, and the guy won the frame, I lost the tournament. You remember, and
all a little bit of baggage almost.
Yeah. But it's there. And I suppose that's where psychologists come in, to make you forget those things and not think about what happened before, just think about before. But yeah, when you're young, you don't care what happens if you miss, go for a long ball.
I want to talk about a snooker player's pre-match routine, okay? Right. So in football, we, like I say, we'll stay in the hotel night before home games, night before away games. We're all eating dinner together at a certain time, all that kind of stuff. You wake up in the morning, you're having breakfast, pre-match. What's it like for a snooker player? Say you're starting at sort of, you're in the world championship final. What time does the world championship final start normally?
The world championship final, the first session would be about 2 PM. So generally I would not get up too early. I was never a breakfast eater.
Yeah.
Go down to the venue about 10-ish, between 10 and 11, have half an hour, no more. I was never a believer in doing lots of practice at a tournament. I thought the work's done before it.
Yeah,
if you've not done it before and prepared, then it's too late to start. So yeah, half an hour, go back to the hotel, maybe have a tiny bit of food to eat. But I was never hungry before playing.
Nerves or?
Never. Yeah, there's obviously something to do with it. I mean, like I had an old coach called Frank Carlin, a real old guy. And he says, have you eaten? And I went, I says, no, this is at 2:30 PM. I hadn't eaten a single thing all day.
Wow.
And he's like, you got to feed your brain. But I says, I'm not hungry. Literally, I'd be fine through the match. Literally afterward, I'd be want to eat the world.
Ravenous.
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of prep, if I was playing at 2:30, I'd arrive at the venue at 2:00. Go to the dressing room, get my cue of the key, go in the practice table, 10 minutes, basically just to loosen up.
Wow.
Go back and go back and read a newspaper in the dressing room.
And then just, that's it, just will you out.
Just try and clear, just try and not think about what's happening. The thing at the World Championship was you could hear the speaker, the auditorium noise coming through, and they used to always play all the snooker tunes through it. So you could always, like the one that would be ITV, Pop Black, BBC, there'd be 4 or 5, and you'd always know the last one. Pop Black was the one close to game time. And then you'd get someone coming in saying 5 minutes, then going in, then you'd go to the toilet or whatever, get your cue, okay, maybe wipe your cue, then it'd be 1 minute, and then, yeah, they knock on the door. But like world finals, I'd be like nauseous. I'd be literally thinking I'm going to throw up here. But looking back now, that's when I played my best.
Yeah.
When I got out there, it just went.
Adrenaline buzz when you walked out.
Yeah.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
You just walk out
game time.
You get on the table and you just, everything goes.
Did you ever, with the adrenaline, like, did you ever, it might be a big final, actually get there and it might take you a frame or two to settle down, like, because of the adrenaline?
Well, that's the thing. If you went certainly later on in the career, if you're in the dressing room, you didn't feel that, then consequently, yeah, you just start to not feel that, get that feeling of excitement and, yeah, I think the nausea is excitement as well, because you think I'm going to win this. This is a world championship. And when you don't have that nerves, you've got to be nervous to play your best, I think.
Yeah, it heightens everything,
you've
doesn't
got to
it?
Be, if you're flat, you ain't going to perform.
And when you were in the kind of midst of the 90s, I guess you were in the changing room just thinking, I'm going to beat anyone.
Well,
was it that mentality?
There was a period from sort of, I won the world championship first in 1990, then again in 92, and obviously from then I won 5 in a row. There was a time in those years, and every I just felt, took winning for granted.
Invincible.
Yeah. I mean, the story, which is true, I told my ex-wife that before going down to the start of the tournament, to bring a certain jacket I want to wear after the final.
Oh, I love that.
So when you come down to the final, can you bring that jacket for me? And that was before the tournament started. So it's like, I just felt invincible, especially at the Crucible and most tournaments, but especially
that's
the Crucible.
Phenomenal. And what about, so if you're playing obviously multiple days in a row, if you're like mid-tournament, what would your like routine be at night? Would it be grab something to eat early night or how did you treat things?
Yeah, I tend to, if I was playing at night, just simple, very
nothing
simple.
Nothing special, yeah.
Very simple. I mean, we stayed in the same hotel in Sheffield, same room, and it wasn't really anything, you know, about being, what's the word?
Superstitious.
Yeah. Just a nice room. Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah, but, and yeah, just we'd same sort of two or three restaurants we'd go to and just back to my room, watch telly. Yeah,
boom, good to go.
You're a bit like that, aren't you?
Yeah, just nothing like, special. It is what
I guess
is.
It's
yeah.
familiarity, isn't
yeah.
it?
Just, yeah. I think if you need to get yourself G'd up for a certain event or then I think you're doing something wrong. It should always just be the same prep for every single one, and then you autopilot them.
And then at the end of the day, it's your job. You know, yeah. My job was to go to the World Championship and win it. It wasn't to go and have a good time and see this or the city. Right? It was just to go there. My job was to go. That's why I never showed a lot of emotion when I lifted a trophy, or you know, I never cried or go crazy or anything, because I thought that's my job.
Yeah.
I've come here to win this World Championship. Yeah. And like, when I won it, right, when's the next one? It
wasn't where's my
like,
jacket?
Yeah.
It was no,
yeah, it was as matter of fact as that, really.
All right, listen, we're going to get some quickfires on in a minute. I want you to just sort of look back on your career, look back as your profession as a snooker player. What is it? Is it a good career? Is it hard work? Are you away a lot? All that kind of stuff, unsociable hours and stuff.
A snooker player's career is tough because you're on your own.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I enjoyed my own company. I didn't mind being alone, you know, because of the traveling and everything. I was always on my own. I had a road manager that drove me around in the UK and stuff and travel, but stayed in my own room and was quite happy. So it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
So I'm going to see players who have never gone anywhere on their own. They bring a mate and because they literally can't stay in a room on their own.
Yeah, yeah.
It's for some people it was tough, but individual sports, I think, I mean, every sport you have to do, put, you know, load of work in to get to the top, every sport, but an individual sport it's those hours, hours and hours and hours on your own doing the same thing over and over. It's one of the things, again, partly my downfall was I'd been doing that practice sessions for like 8-20 years, the same sessions, lineups. The snooker table never changes. Even a golfer, I suppose, who hits thousands of balls, one day the wind could be a different direction. So it's a different
snooker
table's the same. So I stopped being able to do those 5-6 hours. And if you do 4 hours, there's someone doing two more than you.
Yeah, it's not enough.
No. So it's hard in that respect, snooker.
Stephen Hendry, what a legend. Right, we've got some quickfire questions for you, okay? Best player you've ever played against?
O'Sullivan.
Simple as that?
Yeah.
A player that surprised you with just quite how good they were?
I think... It's weird. Steve Davis, when I first came on the scene, I did two tours of Scotland with him, 6 nights. And it was my manager was quite clever, actually, because I got to learn from him. But it was seeing him at close quarters, how good he was and how dedicated he was. Everything that went towards him being the best. You see him and you think, yeah, he's good. But when you got up and close, I thought, yeah, what a machine.
And tell me he's a top man is what he seems.
He is. He's so funny. We've had some great nights.
I love that.
He's a DJ now. I mean, the most random thing ever. Yeah, he's got two. He's had two albums out. I mean, it's not music. It's horrendous. And I tell him that. But I mean, he's done Glastonbury.
No, he's not.
I saw your interview with him when you were asking him the questions and you said about like favourite band and he'd referenced some...
Magma.
Yeah, I didn't.
I mean, what the actual? I mean, who are they?
Yeah, on that. when you did behind the scenes around the event and you different vantage points, studios, you've got to do more of that. I'm not a huge snooker fan,
right?
But found that absolutely fascinating. Cool. Behind the scenes at the
there
event,
you go. Like, we'll definitely do one at the Crucible. Oh, I mean, some of the venues are a bit samey, but definitely the Crucible will be an interesting one.
Get yourself a little GoPro, right? Just walk around, do a little vlog, show behind the curtain, all that kind of stuff.
Have you not seen Stephen when he has it strapped to his head? That's brilliant.
No.
Yeah, that,
the lineup I was on about. I've done a whole video from my point
from
of view.
From what you see.
Yeah. I think it was the latest one out, I think, if I want to say.
Obviously, I haven't watched that one yet.
I haven't watched that one yet.
Cheap meal, your favorite go-to meal. So you've just won the Masters. What are you going to go in for?
Cheap meal.
Cheat
meal. Oh my God. I just love food.
You like cooking, don't you?
Yeah, love cooking, yeah.
What's your favorite go-to meal to cook then?
I cook from cookbooks. I wouldn't say I've got recipes more than from cookbooks, but cheat meal.
Burger,
KFC.
Pieces. Oh, yeah, that's not a bad one to be
fair. Sorry, fried chicken.
Yeah, okay. We'll go KFC, it's fine. What's your favourite movie of all time?
Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, oh, very good. Favourite TV programme, TV show?
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Do you know that one?
I've never seen it.
I know. Well, Larry David is the greatest living human being.
I do like Larry David. What is on your sports bucket list to go and watch or even play in?
It's got to be the Masters.
It's got to be the Masters. There was a couple we've had, so it's like Masters is the right answer. It has to be the right answer. But the other one that we got the other week was the Phoenix. You know the Phoenix Open, the par three down the thing with that.
Rory doesn't like that apparently, doesn't he?
It's too much for him, doesn't like that.
You know, they throw beer and everything.
Could that ever happen in snooker, where the crowd are raucous?
Well, they've got the new one coming out, 10 minutes frames,
and it's shot clocks and stuff, and it works. It's cool. I love watching it. Yeah, I wouldn't like to play in it, but I love watching it.
Yeah, it is. I was watching it on telly last night. I was buzzing off. We were talking about it on the way here, weren't we, Dad? It was brilliant.
I've got a question. Best post tournament party.
Whoa. Well, one of the world titles I won a session early against Jimmy. And because it was a session early, we didn't have an evening. So we had to go back to the Crucible and do Big Break live with the Jim Davidson, John Virgo show.
The evening session should have been.
Because I started drinking earlier, I was absolutely smashed. And then the next day I had to do an appearance at the sweater shop in Meadowhall in Sheffield.
For your Bentley.
You've got to earn that Bentley and Ferrari.
And I had to stop three times to go and be ill in the toilets, the autograph queue. But that was a good one.
I don't know if it's the best one. It's definitely probably the most memorable one. We were playing the Big Break soundtrack earlier, by the way. It's incredible. It's only a game, so put up a real good fight. Yeah. Oh, world class. And finally... Stephen Hendry, like you say, you've won absolutely everything there is to win in snooker. What is the highlight of your whole career?
Oh, wow. In terms of playing?
Yeah.
Winning the seventh world title, obviously beating Steve's record, has obviously got to be a highlight. But, I mean, five world titles in a row and five Masters in a row.
It's not bad, mate. It's not bad. Stephen Hendry, you've been an absolute legend. Thank you for having us.
Thank you
very
much. Been a pleasure.
Up the Foscast.
Up the Foscast.
You don't need to do that. It's fine. You're the man. You don't need to do that.
Thanks, everybody, for watching. We hope you enjoyed the latest episode of the Foscast. Don't forget to give us a follow on Spotify. Up the Foscast.